Hello, I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast dedicated to the unique heritage and local culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. We're joined today by Jeff Bowman, Rob Filipkowski, Carol Peterson, Lynn Stewart, and Mark Wormke, all members of the Opiongo Readers Theatre. And do they have a show for you today? As some of you may remember, about a year ago, we aired an episode called Shanty and River Life. Among its many non-fictional readings, that show included one fictional short story, Bammer's Boom, about some imaginary 19th century lumberjacks and rivermen working along the Madawaska River. It was written by Sir Gilbert Parker, and it piqued our curiosity, given that he said elsewhere that it was a story sparked by an earlier failed attempt at writing fiction when he tried to compose something called Pike Pole Sketches on the Madawaska. Given that Gilbert Parker was born just north of Napanee, lived for a while in the Ottawa Valley, and knew something of our local culture firsthand during the second half of the 19th century, we thought it worth our while to investigate further. Ultimately, we did find something very intriguing. In 1912, Sir Gilbert wrote an introduction to his most famous and first hugely successful work of fiction, a collection of integrated short stories called Pierre and His People. Here's Mark Wormke reading what Sir Gilbert had to say about those earlier sketches from that introduction.
So far as my literary work is concerned, Pierre and His People may be likened to a new city built upon the ashes of an old one. Let me explain. While I was in Australia, I began a series of short stories and sketches of life in Canada, which I called Pike Pole Sketches on the Madawaska. A very few of them were published in Australia, and I brought with me to England in 1889 about 20 of them to make into a volume. I told Archibald Forbes, the great war correspondent, of my wish for publication, and asked him if he would mind reading the sketches and stories before I approached a publisher. He immediately consented, and one day I brought him the little brown bag containing the tales. A few days afterwards, there came an invitation to lunch, and I went to Clarence Gate, Regent's Park, to learn what Archibald Forbes thought of my tales. We were quite merry at luncheon, and after luncheon, which for him was a glass of milk and a biscuit, Forbes said to me, "Those stories, Parker, you have the best collection of titles I have ever known." He paused. I understood. To his mind, the tales did not live up to their titles. He hastily added, "But I'm going to give you a letter of introduction to Macmillan. I may be wrong." My reply was, "You need not give me a letter to Macmillan unless I write and ask you for it." I took my little brown bag and went back to my comfortable rooms in an old-fashioned square. I sat down before the fire on this bleak winter's night with a couple of years' work on my knee. One by one, I glanced through the stories and in some cases read them carefully. And one by one, I put them in the fire and watched them burn. I was heavy at heart, but I felt that Forbes was right, and my own instinct told me that my ideas were better than my performance. And Forbes was right. Nothing was left of the tales. Not a shred of paper, not a scrap of writing. They had all gone up the chimney in smoke. There was no self-pity. I had a grim kind of feeling regarding the thing, but I had no regrets. And I have never had any regrets since. I have forgotten most of the titles, and indeed all of the stories, except one. But Forbes and I were right. Of that, I am sure. The next day, after the arson, I walked for hours where London was busiest. The shop windows fascinated me, they always did, but that day I seemed subconsciously to be looking for something. At last, I found it. It was a second-hand shop in Covent Garden. In the window there was the uniform of an officer of the time of Wellington, and beside it, the leather coat and fur cap of a trapper of the Hudson's Bay Company. At that window, I commenced to build again upon the ashes of last night's fire. Pretty Pierre, or rather the original of him as I knew him when a child, looked out of the window at me. So I went home, and sitting in front of the fire which had received my manuscript the night before, with a pad upon my knee, I began to write The Patrol of the Cypress Hills, which opens, Pierre and his people. The next day was Sunday. I went to service at the Foundling Hospital in Bloomsbury, and while listening superficially to the sermon, I was also reading the Psalms. I came upon these words, "Free among the dead, like unto them that are wounded, and lie in the grave, that are out of remembrance." And this text, which I used in the story, The Patrol of the Cypress Hills, became in a sense the text for all the stories which came after. It seemed to suggest the lives and the end of the lives of the workers of the pioneer world. So it was that Pierre and his people, chiefly concerned those who had been wounded by fate and had suffered the robberies of life and time while they did their work in the wide places. It may be that my readers have found what I tried instinctively to convey in the pioneer life I portrayed, the soul of goodness in things evil. Such on the whole my observation had found in life, and the original of Pierre, with all his mistakes, misdemeanors, and even crimes, was such a one as I would have gone to in trouble or an hour of need, knowing that his face would never be turned from me. These stories made their place at once. The Patrol of the Cypress Hills was published first in The Independent of New York, and in Macmillan's magazine in England. Mr. Bliss Carman, then editor of The Independent, eagerly published several of them, She of the Triple Chevron, and others. Mr. Carman's sympathy and insight were a great help to me in those early days. The then editor of Macmillan's magazine, Mr. Mowbray Morris, was not, I think, quite so sure of the merits of the Pierre stories. He published them, but he was a little credulous regarding them, and he did not pat me on the back by any means. There was one, however, who made the best that is in Pierre and his people possible. This was the unforgettable W. E. Henley, editor of the National Observer. One day at a sitting, I wrote a short story called Antoine and Angélique, and sent it to him almost before the ink was dry. The reply came by return of post. "It is almost, or quite as good as can be. Send me another." So forthwith, I sent him God's Garrison, and it was quickly followed by The Three Outlaws, The Tall Master, The Flood, The Cipher, A Prairie Vagabond, and several others. At length came The Stone, which brought a telegram of congratulation, and finally The Crimson Flag. The acknowledgement of that was a postcard containing these all too flattering words, "Bravo, Balzac!" Henley would print what no other editor would print. He gave a man his chance to do the boldest thing that was in him, and I can truthfully say that the doors which he threw open gave freedom to an imagination and an individuality of conception for which I can never be sufficiently grateful. These stories and others which appeared in the National Observer, in Macmillan's, in the English Illustrated Magazine, and others, made many friends, so that when the book at length came out, it was received with generous praise, though not without some criticism. It made its place, however, at once, and later appeared another series called An Adventurer of the North, or, as it is called in this edition, A Romany of the Snows. Through all the 20 stories of this second volume, the character of Pierre moved, and by the time the last was written, there was scarcely an important magazine in the English-speaking world which had not printed one or more of them. Whatever may be thought of the stories themselves, or of the manner in which the life of the far north was portrayed, of one thing I am sure. Pierre was true to the life, to his race, to his environment, to the conditions of pioneer life through which he moved. When the book first came out, there was some criticism from Canada itself, but that criticism has long since died away, and it never was determined. Plays have been founded on the Pierre series, and one in particular, Pierre of the Plains, had a considerable success with Mr. Edgar Selwyn, the adapter in the main part. I do not know whether, if I were to begin again, I should have written all the Pierre stories in quite the same way. Perhaps it is just as well that I'm not able to begin again. The stories made their own place in their own way, and that there is still a steady demand for Pierre and his people and A Romany of the Snows seems evidence that the editor of an important magazine in New York, who declined to recommend them for publication to his firm, and later published several of them in the same series, was wrong when he said that the tales seem not to be salient. Things that are not salient do not endure. It is 20 years since Pierre and his people was produced, and it still endures. For this, I cannot but be deeply grateful. In any case, what Pierre did was to open up a field which had not been opened before, but which other authors have exploited since with success and distinction. Pierre was the pioneer of the far north in fiction. That much may be said. And for the rest, time is the test, and time will have its way with me as with the rest.
Now, many of you might be happy enough just knowing that Pierre and his people was solidly rooted in Parker's earlier, but failed, pike pole sketches on the Madawaska, or that Sir Gilbert originally hailed from Lennox and Addington, or that he once lived in the Ottawa Valley, or that he became an Anglican curate at the Belleville School for the Deaf. And some of you may even want to know more about how your man from Camden East ended up in Australia in 1886, and yet, 15 years later, somehow managed to get himself knighted in merry old England. Still, what really tickled our fancy was hearing him talk about his early failure at writing fiction. It got us to wondering if, using the wonders of modern digital technology, we might not be able to find even one of those few pike pole sketches of the Madawaska that Sir Gilbert said had been published during his 2 years working as a newspaper editor in Australia in the 1880s. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, we found not one, but four pike pole sketches on the Madawaska published in the back pages of the Sydney Mail newspaper during the first half of 1887. And though Sir Gilbert certainly didn't lay much of a claim to them back then, other than writing them under his known de plume at the time, one curious fellow who called himself Reginald Rex, still, we were pleasantly surprised by the literary quality of those early attempts. But you be the judge. Here, for the first time since 1887, and never before North American or international audiences, we proudly present for your listening pleasure four of Gilbert Parker's pike pole sketches on the Madawaska. The first one, Parson Barriger, is read by Lynn Stewart.
He had broken down at last, and out in the village had gone the word that the parson was going home. The world had heard of him sometimes, when from his backwoods river settlement there came to well-known journals articles full of scientific thought and literary power. He came on the Madawaska with his young wife and little Charlie in the days when there was no one living at Lonesome Valley and very few on Western's Flat. He had boarded at Emmanuel Wickett's till they could put him up the parsonage, and all the river drivers from Rathbun's camp at Bammer's Boom came down to bear a hand. In the few times he had gone to the outer world, they had tried to keep him where his counsel and his education would be of service to the country. That was the way they put it. But nothing could move him from the simple life of his first and only charge. He had grown old with his people. "I want to die in harness," he had always said, and it was granted him. It came on a sultry June day when the daisies were bright on Western's Flat and rafts were slowly drifting down the river. It came so suddenly that but two of all that bore his name as children and grandchildren were gathered in the south room where he lay. He had dozed and wandered in his thoughts all day, and old memories broke freely sometimes from his lips. But when the son of his old friend, whom he had trained for the preacher's life also, came into the stillness of the rose-shadowed room, and standing beside the bed, said slowly, "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publish peace." The old man turned his head toward the sound and seemed to hear and understand. His thin gray hair was thinner now, and the strong brow loftier than it had ever been before. "Canst thou loosen the bands of Orion, or bind the sweet influence of the Pleiades?" he said, half raising up his hand in the teaching way he used to do in the pulpit. He was, in his mind, with the people in the little church now, and his labor was with him. They all knew when he had used the words before. It was on a Sunday in March, just before our boys went out to fight. And he had tried to show how firm the purposes and just were the decrees of the great captain of the heavens. And as he preached, a little bird flew in the chancel pane and, circling round, perched on his shoulder, unseen and unheeded by him, and resting a minute, flew up to the organ loft and out of the window in the belfry tower to cloudland again. "'Twere like an everlasting promise settling on him," Abe Windover said, as he told it afterwards to a crowd of loafers who whittled the dry goods boxes in front of Ben Vandy's shop. And Reuben Turner spoke up slowly as he turned the tobacco to the other cheek. "Well, he's queer and considerable fond of prowling round among the rocks for mosses and gathering beetles. but he's steady as a rock pine when it comes to baptizing and praying. Canst thou loosen the bands? The old wife laid her hand upon his head, the hand that had held his all the way along the long path of life, and now his thoughts, as though moved by the touch, turned to the children. Where's Charlie's wife? Tell Charlie I found a new beetle for him. Tell Charlie to come. Poor old loiterer on the brink. He did not remember that Charlie was sleeping in his sailor grave 5,000 miles away, and had been sleeping there for many a year. Just then the bell from the church in the cedars tolled out slowly on the summer air for a funeral, and he roused himself again and murmured, "In the midst of life, in the midst of life," and the lips trembled, while outside the bees hummed in the honeysuckles and the lilacs, and there was heard the sobbing of the poor who had gathered in the shade of the apple trees and who were with him now in spirit at last. Even Abe Wendover pulled his hat down over his eyes and said mournfully to himself, "Parson, you always done it good." And the parson heard the crying and opened his eyes and sought the face of the old wife. "Oh, don't let the children cry, Agnes. Don't let the children cry. Tell them to come in. Tell Willie to go and see if there's a letter from Flo." Willie had gone down at the front of Company H when they drove the rebels out of Batoche, and Willie's orphan girl leaned her head against his bed now and said softly, "Grandpapa, oh, Grandpapa." She looked very like her Aunt Flo, from whom he wanted the letter, his tender-hearted Flo, who, a bride of 20 summers, went with her artist husband to Italy, and but once felt baby fingers on her own before she looked out to the west, and looking, left the baby and the sunshine behind. He did not know it now. He was living in the past. He was living with his people in the little church that his own hands had helped to build, the people whom he had seen come in and go out before him for 40 years. He had seen them grow up around him, and their children, and even their children's children, and out under the cedars he had laid them away one by one, their spell of toil accomplished. It was only 3 days before that he had buried on the south side. He said it must be on the south side, where she could hear the organ and feel the sunshine better. The sweet-faced organist who had lost her lover, Charlie, his boy Charlie, and had ever since played on and on, growing sweeter and kinder every day, and who had never married. To the little country stations where he had preached, she had always gone with him in sun and snow, and against his awkward dignity, for he was peculiar, people said, her grace stood in strange contrast. Charlie had been one ever-present memory with him, big, brave, willful Charlie, and when she went, he seemed to fail at once. "Why don't the people sing?" he said. The silence seemed to wear on him. As if in reply, outside a woman's voice rose sweetly and softly. "Abide with me, fast falls the eventide. The darkness deepens, Lord, with me abide." It was evening now, and up from the garden there came the scent of fruit and flowers, and in the room the breeze stirred the white curtains gently. The drone of the locusts had ceased, and the flutter of the orioles in the pines. The little child had fallen asleep with its brown curls against the whiteness of his bed, and the old man slept also. It was but for a little. He opened his eyes again, and here at the last gate he knew them all again and smiled. "Lift up the blind," he said, "and let me see the sun as it goes down." The maples on Wearisome Hill were red with the sunset as they lifted up his head. He tried to raise his hand, but it dropped upon the curls of the little child, and with the old wife's cheek against his own, he murmured, "O Lord, let us now, the servant, depart in peace." And so he did. In the morning the people came and looked upon him, and there were no signs of a life's long labor upon his face. It was as that of a little child. They laid him on the south side among the cedars, and a stooped old sexton and a white-haired woman come sometimes, and the old sexton stands as she puts flowers on the grave.
That was Lynn Stewart reading Gilbert Parker's Parson Barriger, one of Gilbert Parker's long-lost pike pole sketches on the Madawaska. The next one up is That Fiddle of Adam Henry, read by Jeff Bowman.
No traveler Adam Henry don't live nigh here. Stranger in these parts, be you? Want to see him, eh? Well, I reckon you ain't heard that Adam Henry don't stop around Western's flat anymore. Where's he gone to? Well, if they treated him right, he's inside the pearly gates. Dead? Yeah, that's it. Gone away. Went to the forever and ever. And if ever there were an archangel that knowed more about music than Adam Henry, I'd like to see him. There ain't no scarlet robe and rings and golden girdles and paradise wings would be too good for him. If Adam Henry are associating with angels and such now, and that is where he ought to be, and likewise Joey, I'll bet he's leading them with his fiddle. They do say, as King David played right down pretty on the harp, but if he played psalms and hymn tunes better, he weren't no better, take him all around. That's where it was. Adam Henry, he were a choir and an orchestry and a silver cornet band. He were harp that once through Terra Halls and the Old 100 and Yankee Doodle and the Doxologer, separate and distinct, pairs and all together. And as for Mr. Mozart and Mr. Mendelssohn and Mr. Wagner, well, if they could have come back from the silent tomb, it would have made them cry to hear old Adam Henry starting their tunes, capering around and haunting the woods on the Madawaska. And I ain't sure that they weren't round, for many a time my skin would feel just all goosey-like, and chills would creep up my backbone to the roots of my hair, and when he'd be playing sometimes in the evening in the pines. But Adam Henry is no more. As Parson Barriger say, he's crossed the dark river. And true enough, it were the river that killed him. If there is a measlier, meaner river on this trunk of earth than the Madawaska, my name or otherwise than Ezra, which is what my godfathers and godmothers did for me. It were the Madawaska what laid him over, played a lone hand and took all the tricks. And when the Madawaska sets out to play, it's an unlikely sort of hand that'll euchre it. Perhaps you never heard Adam Henry play that fiddle of his. Well, sir, it were a strad. That's Latin or scripture, I reckon, but it's what he called it anyway. And proud of it. Well, there were only one thing that he were prouder of, and that were Joey. Joey? Why, his little gal. Joey, short for Josephine. There weren't a man or a boy, for the matter of that, on the Madawaska, but would have fit for Joey. And that fiddle were a caution. When first Adam Henry came to the Madawaska, I were only a boy, but the fiddle were old then. 100 years, he said. But he were young and handsome, though sort of careless-like and dreamy, and kind of sorrowful about the mouth. He used to play then like as if all the folks in the world were in love with each other, and were sorry for it and wanted to die, but couldn't because it were afore the flood. Then Nellie Hazeltine, the purtiest girl on Western's flat, fell in love with Adam Henry, and he just marched her down to Parson Barriger, and the thing was done forever and ever without a hitch. And when Joey were born, he had a christening, and all the neighbors from Lonesome Valley and Dead Man Rapids come up, and he just gripped the fiddle round the neck that night. Adam Henry did, and waving his hand, trembling like out to us, he says, "Boys and girls and everybody, this is a happy day for me. I have roamed from Dan to Beersheba and have been no use to nobody. But now I'm going to do my level best for Nellie and Joey and stay right here among ye, and you knows me, knows I can pike a log or drop a tree with any of ye." And he could. Well, sir, we just raised a shout that came nigh unto the borders of lifting the rafters, and then Lijah Sarles, he called for 3 cheers for Joey. And Joey were lying in the cradle asleep there, but she walked right up and smiled like at Lijah, and he just gripped her under the arms, kisses her, and passes her around. Taste. She tasted like the balm of Gilead. Then Adam Henry says, "Boys, get your partners for a cotillion." There couldn't nobody play a cotillion like him. He'd just sort of rub her neck, the fiddle, I mean, and up and down tender-like, and then he'd draw the bow impudent across her bosom to wake her up. And then she'd open her eyes, sit up, and laugh as plain as a human. And that laugh would echo away off in the caves of Grizzly Hollow, weird and jubilant-like, and rubbing a little rosin on the bow, he'd start us off with honors to partners. I were dancing with Ruby Marshall. She is married Reuben Turner. And it just seemed as if he put a dozen electric batteries into our heels. Ladies chain, all hands round, chasse, swing your partners, gents on the outside, ladies on the in, grand promenade. Why, that fiddle just piled us full of hilarity and packed it down, too. If it weren't for the roof, some of them gals would have been floating off to glory. Why, she poured out waltzes and polkas and Circassian circles and eight-hand reels promiscuous, and every living thing in that house were dancing except the clock. When supper was ready, she laughed until she cried, and I could bear hear her say as plain as Jem Connor's parrot, "Supper for two and a yoke of oxen." And during supper, she leaned up against the china plates in the dresser, apparently about half awake, and priming herself for the rest of the evening. Things had settled down some quiet after tea, and everybody got to pairing off round the house, when Ab Arnott calls out to Adam Henry for one of his homemade tunes. And anyone as ever hear him play his homemade tunes knowed what they meant. Within about 1 o'clock in the morning, and smiling, curious-like, he took her slow and silent from off the dresser, and keen to smoothing her hair out of her eyes, he makes her draw one long, low, deep breath, like a little child, just after it's cried itself to sleep, and its mother's kissing it gentle, and it feels but doesn't know. Then the wind crept up through the pines in Sorrowful Cove, and climbed up over Western's Flat to the cedars on Wearisome Hill. And it seemed as if all the dead men that had ever died, being lost in the woods of Wearisome Hill, stood up, wrung their hands in the moonlight, and tore their hair. And then a great bell from some church outside the world tolled, and they all went back with their hands over their faces to their graves that nobody ever see, for no one ever come back that was lost on Wearisome Hill. Then sudden, things began to brighten up, and the moon rolled up like a golden ball behind ragged spur, all dinted in at the sides, as if it had been up all night bumping around among the foothills. He'd not got ironed out yet. And then there seemed to be built up on Western's Flat, I could see it as plain as I see you, a sort of Jacob's Ladder, and little angel boys were climbing up and down and blowing golden bugles, and some gal angels up near the top kept throwing white flowers down on the Madawaska, which carried them silent to Dead Man Rapids. But some of the angel boys got to quarreling and went to fighting right there on the ladder, and a fat little chap with violet wings just cleared out everyone that was spoiling for a fight. If they hadn't had wings, they'd all have been tumbled into the Madawaska and drowned. And these gals kept throwing flowers on that little fat violet wing chap, just as they do in actual life to the chap that wins. There ain't no calculating what gals will do. And right in the middle of the row, a big horn blew as loud as 7 sawmills, and these angels hand in hand scampered up into the sky, where the doors were a sheet lightning like gold, and a singing seraph let them in, and they drew the ladder in after them. I tell you, traveler, I felt like church going in. It was that good. And I got sweet-like on Ruby Marshall. People is more or less good when they're in love, I reckon. Adam Henry, he bent his cheek down to her and give her a chuck under the chin. Then he gathered her head up close to his throat and shut his eyes. And it were summer down on Rathbun's camp at Bamber's Boom, and all the boys was working at the jam of logs in the river and prying with their pike poles on shouting, "Ohio, Ohio, hi." Even all the time some robins kept piping in the willows on the banks, and some black squirrels were keeping time with their bushy tails on old maple stumps, and then the jam broke, and away went the logs. You could hear them jostling, crowding, crashing, and gnawing each other. The water was dancing hornpipes all the way to Dead Man's Rapids, and everything were lovely. It were naturaler than life. But he wasn't through yet. He rolled up his eyes, loosened her clothes like, and started her again. She toted in all the old songs we ever knew, none of them quite alone, but all going on at the same time. Greenland's icy mountains were jostling away down south in Dixie, and the gal I left behind me were capering round with old Black Joe. And when tentin' tonight on the old campground came in, you could see the battleground and the soldiers lying stiff under the cold white moon. And all through it, the dead march was sighing and sighing like the inside of the earth with the heart disease. I could, then and there, lay down beside him and never stirred again. And Ruby Marshall, she were burying her face in her hand when ker-ching, ker-burr, ker-clang, we were right in the middle of Johnny Comes Marching Home again, and there's a good time coming. 100 brass bands were playing. It were noon all over the world, and the ocean were tipsy and were bumping on its shoulders up again the Rocky Mountains. The sky was full of birds and nests of daisies, and the clouds was having a holiday. And every living gal in the land, wall-eyed, all had a lover. And I just tightened my grip around Ruby Marshall, and we were going to make a fool of myself before the hall company, when sudden Adam ran us down on a thunderstorm to the old Madawaska. And before I could rub my eyes, we were 25 of us on the floor, dancing away like mad to the tune of the Irish Washerwoman, as if it were school letting out and there weren't no day of judgment. I said it were the Madawaska that killed Adam Henry, and I stick to it. There ain't no man in Peavy County but knows it. You see, about 20 years had passed over the hills, and Adam Henry were getting up into the sear and yellow. Nellie had slipped away into Kingdom Come in the dark one night, about the time another little stranger like Joey were expected, and being kind of queer in her head, had drowned herself in Turley's Eddy, or she'd missed her footing and tumbled in. Adam Henry just went into low water at once, and the fever towed him near over the bar, and when he got up again, his hair were white as snow, and the world were dark to him, for he were stone blind. It were a sad sight to see Joey, so patient-like and pensive, leading him around with his fiddle, in which he played for us year after year at every dance on the Madawaska until the Christmas of 75. That day we had as rousing a flare-up at Abe Wendover's as ever was seen on Western's flat. It were a green Christmas. There weren't any snow, and the ice on the river had blocked at Bamber's Boom. Adam Henry lived just over the river from Wendover's, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, the moon shining bright in Joey's face, they started across the ice for home. Now, Abe and I were pouring a libation. Libation was one of Adam Henry's words. To the sweet eyes of Joey, for Abe were looking sly-like that way, when we heard a roar and a crash, and Abe shouted, "Lord, help him, the ice is broke on the river." There were a heaving, pounding, crowding, angry mass in the center of the river on one clear block. Adam Henry were standing with his fiddle in one hand and one arm around Joey. His gray hair was blowing about in the wind, and his face was lifted up to the moon. We could see Joey put her hand to his face and stroke it. All at once, the ice on either side gave way, leaving them stranded on a narrow piece on Devil's Head Rock. Before we could launch a boat, it broke loose too and started down the stream, we all the time calling to him and helpless. Joey raised her hand and waved it to us, as if she was saying goodbye. And Adam Henry lifted his fiddle to his chin and drew his bow across her, and they floated down that black river to death. He was calm as I am this minute. The first sound was tremulous and pitiful. Then it cheered up a little, like as if a soul had just got out of purgatory. And when they got near Turley's Eddy, we could hear him playing, while Joey sang like an angel let out of heaven. But the ice broke on Judas Rock, and the white faces went with Adam Henry's fiddle to wherever Nellie was. "'Pears to me you must have knowed Adam Henry, traveler." "What's that you say?" "His brother." "Well, Nellie was my sister." "I reckon if Parson Beauregard were here, he'd say a prayer."
That was Jeff Bowman reading The Fiddle of Adam Henry, one of Gilbert Parker's long-lost Pike Pole sketches on the Madawaska. Our next sketch today is The Judge of Powder Rock. It's read by Carol Peterson.
In the settlement, he was generally known as the judge, but, according to circumstances, he was given other names as well. If there happened to be any war scare, and rumors of it reached the village, and were carried up the river to Bamber's Boom, he was consulted as the colonel, and then he would stand under the big pine and prophesy. If there were anybody sick, someone went to the little log house at Powder Rock, and then he was called the doctor. If any point of difference arose between the neighbors, they fell back on the name Abe Wendover gave him first, the judge. And, as there was a good deal of that sort of thing, he was christened the judge for all general purposes. He was proud of any of them, answered to them all, and was equal to them all. He was the same to them as Parson Barriger was to the people in the village away below. His coming happened this way. One day in June, when the sun was like a brass furnace overhead, and the logs were jammed and blistering all down the Madawaska, the river drivers sat under the big pine drinking their basins of tea and smoking their corncob pipes. Mail day only came once every 2 months, and when the stage came round into Little Bend, every man took a pull at his red sash and stood up. When the stage stopped in front of the big pine, there was but one passenger, and Jerry Stanham, the driver, winked and touched his forehead. The passenger got out, took a carpet bag in one hand, a tin box in the other, and stood in the middle of the road, looking round him. Presently he put them both down, took another little tin box out of his vest pocket, opened it, and, taking some white powder out of it, put it on his tongue. Then he looked at the crowd and blew a long breath between his pressed lips. A white ulster, a black cord with an eyeglass attached, and a wide Panama hat were the striking points in his costume. He wasn't the kind of man seen often in the Madawaska. He was dirty and tired, but as if he were too proud to show it. He kept on looking up and down, as if he were sighting a place for a likely piece of square timber. Abe Wendover seemed to scent the difficulty, and he shoved his hat back on his head and struck over to where the old man stood. "Well, Judge," said Abe, "glad you've come. We weren't expecting you so soon, but there's some side pork in the root cellar, and some sass in the buttery, and I guess we can worry along till potato time." The old man drew himself up and said, "Thank you, my friend. I was looking for a place of residence. I intend to stay here some time." Then he opened the little tin box and offered Abe some of the white powder. "Excellent thing for the digestion, soothing and kind. Take a little, 'twill do you good." But Abe said, "Judge, you're powerful kind, and I'm as obliged as if I had et the whole cargo. But I always take mine and a finger of old rye and a little water. But I reckon, Judge, it's getting high time we was getting home." Then he took the carpet bag and would have taken the tin box, but the judge said, "I'll carry that, please." And they started over the bridge while the crowd stood round and made bets as to who the judge was. Reuben Turner said he guessed Abe had struck oil, goose oil. But Abe Wendover had a level head and could lift more than any other man on the river. And when he wanted to strike oil, it didn't pay to interfere with him. The judge stayed with Abe nearly all summer, and in the fall went to live in the little log house at Powder Rock and set to work to cut down underbrush pine for his winter's wood. But the settlement had a bee one day and cut enough to last him all year. As Abe Wendover said, "What was the use of having a judge if he had to cut his own kindling and ladle out law for a whole district? He had a little money, very little, but he helped things along at last by the old tin box. When Ike Carson fell ill with rheumatic fever, which was a common thing among the river drivers, the judge took his old tin box down, sent everybody out of the room, stayed with Ike 2 hours, and when he came out, Ike was fast asleep, and, as his wife said, quiet as a lamb, him that been raving like a wild bull nigh 2 days. In 2 or 3 days, Ike got up and came down to the big pine and said, "Boys, the judge is the tallest kind of a Moses and Elias and all the prophets. He could cure the pains of forever and ever, derned if he couldn't. That there tin box of his are balm of Gilead, no mistake." After that, the judge had plenty to do, and he took his pay in what Ike called fodder. The judge's thoughts seemed always far away, and many a night, when the sun was making a great fire in the west, and the pines were like flaming needles on Wearisome Hill, they could see him standing beside Powder Rock, with arms folded, and looking out towards the sunset, as if he expected somebody to come that way. Abe Wendover used to say, "There is something weighing on the judge's mind. There ain't no doubt about that. He's always looking out to somewhere as if he's lost something. Poor old judge. He's like what Parson Berger would call a tower of salvation in fever time." The judge had been there about 4 years when one day he came, as he always did at mail time, to the big pine. When the letters were handed out, Ike Carson said, "Here's one for Joseph Parne. I guess there ain't nobody of that name here." But the judge stepped forward, saying, "That letter is for me." His hand trembled as he took the letter, and his lips grew white as he opened it. Then he lighted up and said, with a flush on his old face, "Jack's coming tomorrow." He made a passionate motion with his hand out towards the east, and turned and left them. The old man had never spoken of Jack or anyone else belonging to him, and all the settlement wondered that night over their pipes and cider who Jack was and what he would be like when he did come. The next morning, dressed in the same clothes that he wore when they saw him first, he came down to the big pine and waited till some of the people gathered round him. Taking the little tin box from his pocket, he offered it to Abe Wendover and said, "Excellent thing for flatulence and kindred disorders. Take a little, 'twill do you good." But Abe said, "Judge, we take ours wet, we do, and about a half a finger straight." The old man fumbled with the eyeglass for a moment, blew a long breath between his shut lips as though to steady himself, and slowly said, "Gentlemen of the Madawaska, I am prepared, as you see, for the reception of somebody. I am going out to meet him. He's coming this afternoon. Years ago, a great many years ago, a young mother put her firstborn into my arms and said, 'Call him Jack. Love him and watch over him. And always remember that I am watching too.' And then she shut her eyes, and the lilacs have been growing on her grave for 30 years. I took care of him as well as I could, and a bright-faced boy he was, loving and generous and never any trouble till he grew up to be a man. And then he had too many friends. I lost what money I had, and he went away, and I have not seen him for 7 years. I got a letter from him yesterday, and he says," here he took the letter out of his pocket and opened it, "he says, 'The prodigal is returning to his father, bringing with him a wound he got fighting Louis Riel's half-breeds and Indians on the Saskatchewan. Gentlemen of Madawaska, he is coming this afternoon. I am now going out to meet him.'" The wind was blowing his white hair about his head, and his face was like a prophet's as he started to go. Abe Wendover took off his hat and said, "Judge, there don't stand a man along the Madawaska but would stick like a burr to you. You are the liveliest kind of a parent, and there ain't a prodigal returning anywhere that'll be more welcome, free and gratis, than this here prodigal you mention, Cap'n Jack. Judge, we're proud of you." The old man took off his hat, offered them the contents of the little tin box, and started out on the Little Bend Road. They were excited in the settlement all day, and Reuben Turner brought his cornet down to the bridge, and they got the only flag the settlement had and put it up on a fork of the big pine. In the evening, before the sun had dropped behind Wearisome Hill, they saw them coming. The judge and a tall, broad-shouldered young man. When they passed under the flag, the old man took off his hat, and the young man saluted, while Reuben Turner played, "There's a Good Time Coming." Then little Meg Carson ran up and pulled at the leather leggings of the bright-faced prodigal, and he took her up and kissed her twice. From that moment, every woman and child in the settlement was his friend. It was a way he had with him. He had brown hair, laughing blue eyes, and an air like a prince, but a weak mouth and no purpose about him. He wasn't fond of work, but when he did work, he was a giant. He could do anything, from squaring a timber to paring apples and making cider. Sometimes he went back to his old ways for a few days, and then Abe Wendover would get him out of the way and tell the judge that he had gone up the river fishing. He was afraid of nothing. When some of the river drivers got to quarreling one night at Bamber's Boom and pulled out their knives, Captain Jack struck in between them and said coolly, "You'll have to carve me first, boys. There isn't going to be any cutting this season on the Madawaska." He had his way. He always would. As Ike Carson said, "Gee-rickety! A man has a right to keep things straight when he's killed Injuns and half-breeds and stood beside Middleton at Cut Knife Creek. Gee-rickety!" Things went this way for 2 years. Captain Jack loved to take his boat at night, light the pine knots in the stern, and paddle over to the eddy where the pickerel and pike were. Many a night he could be seen standing in the flare of the red fire, spear in hand, and behind him the rock pines crowding up to Wearisome Hill. One night in September, he went as usual to the eddy, and the judge stood watching him from Powder Rock. The pines were cool and sighing. Some nighthawks hung about the maples. And in Lizard Cave, a coon was crying like a child. The old man stood there a long time, and then he went in, opened the tin box, and took a portrait from it. He looked at it a moment and said, "I did my best, Daisy. He has come back." Then he went to the door and waved his hand out to the figure in the boat. Jack loved to sleep out of doors at night, and many a night he lay on a heap of pine branches or in a boat on the river. He had been so much on the prairies that he said a house was too small for his lungs. So, this night, he threw the rope over a snag and went to sleep on the river. The river had been low, and that night a dam above broke loose. The water rose, the rope slipped from the snag, and the boat and Jack drifted down to Dead Man Rapids. In the morning they found him at the slide below, with a smile on his cold, dead face. They brought him tenderly to Powder Rock, and the judge saw them coming. He understood at once. Abe Wendover took off his hat and said, "Judge, he were a brick. If he were a prodigal, God doesn't make that kind of a prodigal every day. Don't feel bad, Judge." But the judge only stared blindly at the quiet form on the cedar branches and said, "My boy, my poor boy." They laid him under a maple where the sun could always reach his grave in the morning on Western's Flat. The judge grew whiter and whiter every day. And one Sunday they missed him from Powder Rock. They went to Jack's grave and there they found him, with the tin box by his side and a portrait of a brown-haired girl in his dead hand. They sleep there side by side, and many a time Abe Wendover says to the group under the big pine, "Things ain't been the same down here since the judge and Jack went away."
That was Carol Peterson reading The Judge at Powder Rock, written by Gilbert Parker, one of his 20 thought-to-be-lost pike pole sketches on the Madawaska. Finally, we have The Strike at Bammer's Boom, read by Rob Filipkowski. It brings us full circle to that first short story we brought to you at this time last year, Bammer's Boom, that was eventually published as part of Gilbert Parker's very successful collection of short stories, Pierre and His People.
"You haven't no call to sit there all day and forever weaving, Aunt Kate. You haven't no call, and it does no good. Better come and go down to Dave's with me. He'll be home from the mill now. Liza's poorly, too. And it'll cheer her up if you go to her as you used to do. I think you'd better come, Aunt Kate. Click, click, went the shuttle, and back again. Click, click, and then it stopped. The old woman moved her hand slowly over the rag carpet on the frame, as though to test its strength, and she then turned and said, I will go with you tonight, Merce. I haven't been to David's since then. As she said the last word, she turned slowly round and took a little tin portrait from a ledge of the bloom, and looked at it, with her lips pressed tightly together. She kissed the face in the picture and put it back again. He was always different from the rest, she said. He never could stand any meanness, but he hadn't such social ways as some have. Matt hadn't. He'll come back, though. He'll come back, but I must keep on weaving. Just then, between the leaves of a maple at the window, a ray of light struck in from the west and fell straight upon the portrait. The old woman saw it, and lifting up her hand, long and brown with labor, she pointed to it and said, See, Merce, the Lord has given us a sign, and his promise never faileth. Then a hush fell upon the little room. The old woman sat with her head bowed upon her arms at the bare pine table, and the girl leaned her forehead against the window casing and looked out across the Madawaska. The tinkle of a cowbell roused them. Aunt Kate spoke first. Her voice was strong and deep. Her nature was wonderfully so, and her large, angular body had a sense of calmness about it and strength. Just such a woman as you will find among the mountains and rivers. Come, Merce, she said. I'll weave when I get back. Put two of them black bass you caught this afternoon in the basket, and I'll carry some huckleberries for Liza. The wooden latch clicked, and the two stepped out into the summer evening. Across the river upon a rock, near a ragged spur, overhung with cedar branches, a man crouched and peered out with a pale, despairing look until the two forms appeared at the doorway. And then he rose and stretched his arms out pleadingly and hopelessly and said, Mother, Merce. As if they heard them, they turned their faces toward Ragged Spur for a moment and then passed on. 2 years before, the mill hands and river drivers, because their life was hard and the pay small, struck at Bamber's Boom, and gathered themselves together in the evenings of July, and swore that not another log should drift down the Madawaska until more pay was given them. The winters were hard upon them, and times weren't so good as they used to be. They were mostly good fellows at heart, but rough and ignorant, and were led by a man from the shanties of Michigan, Jim Jordan, who had brains and the devil in him. But Page, the owner, was not to be moved. It is not right, he said, for me to give you what you ask. I lose sometimes year by year, but you must be paid. I gain 1 year, and you rise up and would take from me, my men, what has long been my due. I cannot and will not do it. If the axe is heard no more in the woods, and the logs drift no more down the river, why, I am ruined, of course. But at the same time, you ruin yourselves. I have done my best for you. And he turned and went away into the shadow of the pines. Then Jim Jordan stood up and scoffed at all the master, Charles Page, had said, told them in what state he lived in Montreal, taunted them, and heated them till they shouted, We will set fire to the little mill. That will bring him to his senses. They were blind. But Matt Dias knew that they were wrong. I tell you, boys, he said, this means the bread of every one of us, and Jim Jordan lies. He's not one of us. He came from God knows where. I have as much to work for as any of you, and I tell you, we are only cutting our own throats. Burn down the little mill, and do you suppose Page will let you work at the big mill? It's a game that two can play at, and it'll be a losing game for you. Jim Jordan lies. He's a big-talking Yankee, and he lies. Matt was a heavy-browed, broad-shouldered fellow, noted for his silent ways and for the queer things that he had done and said. But now his speech was rough and angry, and they had no patience with him. They did not understand him. They called him a coward, skunk. And Jim Jordan came down from the pine stump where he had been talking, tightening his red sash as he did so, and taking a piece of tobacco from his mouth, walked up to Matt and threw it in his face. Matt struck him, and he fell like a log, striking his head against the iron spikes of some pike poles that were driven in a piece of timber. The crowd closed in on Matt, but he seized a handspike, cleared his way through them, and struck into the woods. Jim Jordan died. Still, the mill was not burned that night, nor was the work stopped on the river any longer. But Matt Dias was seen no more at Bamber's Boom. They made a martyr of Jim Jordan, They came to the little house where Matt's mother sat weaving and told her what her son had done. Her face grew white, but she only turned towards Wearisome Hill and stretched out her hands and said nothing. She went back into the house, and when Merce Wickett came next morning, she found her at the loom and the picture on the frame. Merce and Matt had loved each, and she did not deserve him in his trouble. Her father, Emmanuel Wickett, hard man in some things, and he had told her that she must never darken the door of the murderer of Jim Jordan. But Aunt Kate was old, and she was alone, and her brain was going. So Merce stayed with her and gave up all the rest. Dick Dias, Matt's father, had been killed by a falling tree. The only daughter had been drowned in Dead Man Rapids, and now Matt was gone. The people had been used to call her Aunt Kate, but now none came near her save Dave and Parson Barriker. She had but one thought, she and Merce, and that was to make enough by weaving and berry-picking to follow and find Matt and start the world again. 2 years had gone, and still he had not come back, and Merce had twice gone to Ottawa, but could find no trace of him. The house in the burnt, leafless pines that looked so ghost-like on moonlit nights was very lonely. Sometimes Merce went to Parson Barriker's at the village below, and the people stared at the young girl in the checkered flannel dress, whose eyes were steady as a man's, and large with a faraway look. They knew her history, and many pitied her, but she invited no confidence. Some of her own sex sneered at her, but this is a way women have. They crossed the bare waste fields slowly, and out on the rock at Ragged Spur, the figure watched them and shook as with cold. "It was better for them," he said, "that I went away. But it is worse than death." Dave was the manager of the mill, and Liza, his wife, was a niece of Aunt Kate's. They had not forsaken her, nor Merce either. Dave had seen them coming and came to the gate to meet them. Come in, Aunt Kate. Liza will be glad to see you. Come in, and Merce and I will leave you two together and go over and look at the new upright saw we put in the big mill." When they stood inside the mill, Dave turned and said, "They're going to strike again, Merce. There's mischief brewing. Some of the French hands from Gilmore's have come down, and things are looking dark again. I'm afraid they'll do some harm if Page doesn't give them what they ask. Darn them, they know what they want. I've done my level best for them, and they are all right if they are let alone. But a couple of devils can poison 1,000 honest men. Matt saved us last time, Merce, but they don't understand it. Poor Matt." She turned with a fiery gleam in her eyes. "They call him a murderer, Dave. And he's God knows where. He saved them then, but who'll save them now? And who will give us our old Matt again? He's no murderer, and he's better than them all." Next morning the shuttle shot back and forth, and the old face was drawn up towards the portrait, as it had been for many days. Merce looked many times towards the mill that day as she sewed the rags and wound them for the loom. At dinner time she saw the men were excited and restless. Trouble was at hand. "They'll strike today," she said. The air was very still in the August weather. At 5 o'clock, the whistle of the big mill gave a shriek, a frightened, sudden shriek of alarm. "The signal for the strike," Merce said, and went to the door. No, not the strike. Men and women were rushing towards the river, and out there in the swift current was the big raft that had been tied up in Lizard Cove, drifting slowly towards the bridge, and on it a group of children. Dead Man Rapids were below. They were near the bridge now. No boat could reach them. The gigantic oars lay motionless. The children did not understand the danger. If they went safely through the rapids, what could save them was the slide, which was only large enough for the raft to go through if properly steered. If they did not drift toward the slide, they must go over the dam. They're near the bridge. But look, a figure rushes on the bridge, and as the raft passes under it, jumps for it. It's a height of 20 feet, and as he falls, one leg is broken above the ankle between the timbers of the raft. He drags himself towards the rear outside oar. They recognize him, and Merce calls to him, "Matt! Matt!" He'd come back, but would he save the children? Two arms against the tide and the rocks. They pass safely through Dead Man Rapids. They near the slide. Will he make it? He seems to have a giant's strength. They're in the clean, cold rush of water now, a raft's length from the slide. The task for a dozen men to guide it safely through, but for one, oh God. His head is bare, and all the children are near him looking up into his face. There's no cry, no voice, no sound heard for a moment, only hands clasped convulsively as the raft touches and strikes one outer timber of the slide. The timber gives. The raft swerves, shudders, slips, rights herself, and goes through like a dart. Saved! They brought him home with the children. Merce walked behind and once leaned over and said, "At last." Aunt Kate held his hand. When they came to the spot where the thing was done, that had driven him out from among them, he shuddered and raised his hand for them to stop. "Not now, Matt," Merce said, but he only shook his head. "I must speak. I didn't mean to kill him, boys, but he was a curse to us all. You can do what you like with me. I'll stand my trial, and you can kill me if you will. It'll only be a life for a life." There was silence for a moment, and then Ike Carson stepped forward and said, "The first dern magistrate that sticks his head near the Madawaska will be put on a log and set adrift to find his way home into glory. Matt Dias, give us your hand. You saved us once by what you did from something worse, and you've saved our children now. We've all been derned fools. Blind as badgers, the whole crowd. I ain't much, but I'll lick any man that don't say Matt Dias is the bulliest feller on the Madawaska. We was going to strike tonight and make a bonfire of the little mill. That strike ain't worth a continental now. Derned if it is. This beats it hollow. It would be slashing good to have a sermon from Parson Barger. Derned if it wouldn't. But if anybody can sing the doxologer, I'll take up the collection, and I can't say no fairer than that." He couldn't. That night there was a fire, but it was a bonfire by the river. And Dave sent down a barrel of hard cider and some pans of doughnuts, and they played euchre for tobacco. And from the little house, among the burnt pines, three figures sat watching them, and the little portrait was down from the loom.
That was Rob Filipkowski reading The Strike at Bammer's Boom, the last of our four Pike Pole sketches on the Madawaska, all written by Gilbert Parker and all thought to be lost forever. That ends, at least for today, our current investigation into the Pike Pole sketches of the Madawaska, if not the life and times of Gilbert Parker. Still, our real reason for being interested in those early Parker short stories in particular has everything to do with their subject matter, namely the life and times of those imaginary rivermen and their families along the Madawaska River in the 19th century, when places like Barry's Bay and Cumbermere, Whitney and Madawaska were the epicenter of the North American lumber trade. And so it gave us great pleasure to bring you four of those Pike Pole sketches on the Madawaska today. This is probably the first time anybody has heard them in nearly 136 years, and certainly never since the height of Gilbert Parker's worldwide fame in the first half of the 20th century. A final word about Sir Gilbert. Despite those somewhat rough early beginnings in the fiction trade in the 1880s, he was no slouch as a dedicated writer of romantic and historical fiction. At one time, three of his novels made the top 10 annual best-selling novels list in the United States, with two of his novels staying on that annual list for 2 years in a row. As well, his plays were often produced in the West End of London, and his poetry was sometimes set to music by such famed Edwardian composers as Sir Edward Elgar. Meanwhile, back in America, dozens of his short stories and novels were turned into silent-era Hollywood movies, with some even making the transition into talkies. Indeed, Gilbert Parker's stories were still gracing the silver screen well past the Second World War. He was also elected to the British Parliament in 1900 and served there for 18 years, including offering considerable executive service to the British Empire during the Great War. Yet for all that, when he died in 1932, he requested that he be buried in his beloved Hastings County, back in eastern Ontario, and where his spirit still remains today, if only in such places as here at the Opyango Line. I'm Kristen Barshand, and for Jeff Bowman, Rob Filipkowski, Carol Peterson, Lynn Stewart, Mark Wormke, and our producer, Barry Conway, good day, and God bless.